All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Three Ideas in 30 Minutes, Erev Rosh Hashanah style. First, I want to thank our sponsors for this evening, Dr. Michael and Marilyn Fedak, in gratitude for the many weekly learning opportunities at BRS. We continue to be grateful to the Fedaks and sponsored very generously for Refuah Shleima, for Yehudis Kayla Bas Chana Malka, as we continue to daven for a Refuah Shleima for her. I also, before we begin, just want to thank all of you. A shiur is only as good as the participants. Now, I know you only come for the hot dogs and the onion rings and the cholent and the... Okay, but maybe you catch a little Torah along the way. But I want everyone here to know how much I appreciate you and I appreciate that you come and how much I enjoy. I look forward to Thursday nights together. It's really become a very special chevra, a very special group. And please God, in the zchus of our learning... we should be all zoche and our families to a ksiva ksima tova, a good benched yur. Okay, idea number one comes from the Musaf service on Rosh Hashanah. In Musaf, we say the following line, V'haya bayomahu yitaka b'shofar gadol, quoting the pasuk from Yeshayahu, that in the day of the final redemption, we will blow the big shofar. Now asks, this is from Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, one of his sermons that he once gave. And he asked the following question. He says, wait a second. If there is a big shofar, that means there's also a little shofar. I have a friend who got married, and he married a girl named Esti. And at the Ufruf, he spoke about how Esti has a cousin, also Esti. So there's two cousins, each named after the same grandparent, both named Esti. So what do they do in the family? There's big Esti and little Esti. So he made a whole thing at the Ufruf that he was zocha to marry little Esti because he feels bad for big Esti. No girl wants to be known as big Esti, right? It's like big Bertha is a golf club, nothing else, right? So that's what we're talking about here. What's a shofar gadol? Do I have to edit that? What's the shofar? Anyone named Bertha, I apologize, right? What's the shofar gadol? What's the big shofar? That implies there's a little shofar. So he quotes here the Medrash. And the Medrash says, yes, there was a big shofar, and there was also a little shofar. He writes, the great shofar came from the ram offered by Avram at Akedas Yitzchak. The small shofar is the one that was blown at Har Sinai with the revelation of Hashem. So we know that we're going to read about tomorrow, 2 days. We're going to read the story of Akedas Yitzchak, and when Avram Avinu takes Yitzchak up, and instead of Yitzchak, Hashem shows him a ram, that's why we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. There's another shofar, and that's the shofar that Klal Yisrael heard at Har Sinai. So says the Medrash, the shofar of Avram Avinu was the shofar gadol. The shofar of Har Sinai was the shofar gadtan. It was the small shofar. Now, ask Rabbi Lamb, that doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense. After all, Har Sinai was the greatest moment of revelation in all of mankind. How could that be the small shofar? How could that be second fiddle to the shofar gadol of Avram Avinu? If anything, I would have thought the opposite, that Har Sinai was the climactic moment of Jewish history. That would have been the Shofar Gadol.
And the
Yalkut Shimoni, Medrash. I could send it to you inside if you want. So says Rabbi Lamb the following, very beautifully. He quotes Rabbi Soloveitchik, who says that at Har Sinai, who initiated Har Sinai? Was it man or Hashem?
Man.
It was Hashem. It was what we would call in Hasidic thought, Isarusa Delela. In other words, we sat there, we were somewhat passive recipients, and Hashem gave us the Torah. As opposed to the Akedah, who does the hard work at the Akedah? It is Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu is putting in all the effort of the Akedah. So he writes here the following. At Sinai, the Jewish people waited passively and quietly for Hashem to reveal himself. That very morning of revelation, as the Midrash so perceptively tells us, the Jewish people overslept and had to be awakened by Moshe. So just think about the imagery. The Klal Yisrael is literally asleep at the wheel. And if Hashem didn't sound the alarm clock, namely the shofar, they would have slept right through Har Sinai. At the Akedah, on the other hand, Avram rose early, by Ashkem Avram Baboker. And on that mountain, when he forced himself to offer up his beloved only son, he broke his great heart and revealed its noble contents to Hashem, who is the spectator in this drama of man's greatness. The shofar of the Akedah is therefore the shofar gadol, the great shofar, for it summons man to rise to God with all his might. The shofar of Har Sinai, where Klal Yisrael was the spectator at God's drama, was the shofar katan, the small shofar. And that is why the shofar that heralds the redemption cannot be a shofar katan. It's not going to be passive. Rather, it's going to be the shofar gadol, jolting us out of our semi-sleep, galvanizing us to wake up, to act bravely and heroically, to bestir ourselves to new goals and new aspirations on behalf of God and Torah and Israel. So now, why do I love this idea so much? First of all, I just think it's a beautiful imagery. The shofar gadol, the shofar katan, it's a beautiful dar Torah. You could share it at your yontif table, contrast and compare the Akedah to Har Sinai. But I love the point that he makes about it, which is that Har Sinai, even though it may have on paper looked like a more climactic moment for Klal Yisrael, we were passive. And anytime we're passive, it's almost less impressive. We're spectators. Hashem's doing everything. We're sitting on the sidelines. What made Akedas Yitzchak so impressive is that it was man's, not just involvement, but it was man's intuition, it was man's ingenuity, it was mankind's proactive desire to come close to Hashem. Now, obviously, why do we reference this on Rosh Hashanah? And why did Rabbi Lam give this drasha on Rosh Hashanah? Because that's what Rosh Hashanah is. Rosh Hashanah is not a passive holiday. It's not a holiday where we sit back, sip pina coladas, and say, Ashkei Hashem, now that we're sitting back, perform all the miracles, create salvation, and redeem us. It's not what Rosh Hashanah is about. Rosh Hashanah is about the hard work that you and I put in. That's why Akedas Yitzchak plays such a seminal role within the story of Rosh Hashanah. Because Rosh Hashanah is not a holiday where we're supposed to be passive. Rosh Hashanah is a holiday where we're supposed to be active. We're not the objects of history. We are the subjects, right? We're not passive observers, but rather we are active participants. It's something to think about as we go into Rosh Hashanah, that it's not about Hashem waiting to come to us, but it's about us proactively waiting to come to Hashem. We can't just sit there and say, Hashem, inspire me. Hashem, make circumstances better for me. No, no, no. It's we have to put in the first step, as we spoke about a number of weeks ago at Rosh Chodesh Elul. We have to put in the first step. We have to put in the effort. And if we put in the effort, then not only will Hashem meet us halfway, but it'll open doors for us. But it's we who have to put in that effort first. And so many people wait around for change. They wait around for inspiration. You know where it's going to come from? It's going to come from you. It's going to come from you trying new things. It's going to come from you putting in a little bit of effort. It's going to come from you taking on Kabbalahs, taking on commitments to yourself this year that are going to push you a little bit out of your comfort zone. It's about you giving a little bit to Hashem and saying, Hashem, I know I may have been stuck. I might feel like I'm stuck in who I am and where I am in life, but I'm going to push myself a little bit. And if we put in a little bit of that effort, then it becomes the shofar gadol. That's ultimately what Hashem yearns and wants from us. That is idea number one from Rabbi Lam. I think it's a very beautiful idea. Number two, our Hebrew source this evening comes from the Eish Kodesh. This is one of my all-time favorite ideas. The Eish Kodesh, so we know, first of all, his mother didn't call him Eish Kodesh, right? We should just, okay? Eish Kodesh is his seminal book, his most famous book. But he had other svarim as well. One of them, which if you come to the class on Rosh Hashanah, which I highly recommend, I don't usually recommend my classes. This is not like a flex. I happen to really enjoy preparing it. And I like it really impacted me. So generally, when I'm impacted by it, I think other people are going to impact it as well. I think you'll gain a lot from the class on Rosh Hashanah. It's going to cause you to think a lot. So if you don't like thinking, don't come. But if you do like thinking... So first of all, you should see the first of our Torah. It's on the first day of Rosh Hashanah in between Mincha and Maariv. So what else are you going to do? There's nothing else doing between Mincha and Maariv. You have to really want to not be in shul, to leave in between Mincha and Maariv. If anything, by the way, I give you a cover. That's how I always start my shir. Right? You're not supposed to sleep on Rosh Hashanah. But if you're in a shir and you happen to doze off, okay, then Hashem will forgive you. So I always say, I'm your cover. You can all come into my shir and fall asleep, and you'll feel a lot better about yourself. Anyways, I digress. So the Eish Kodesh, his mother didn't call him the Eish Kodesh. He had other svarim as well. One of them we're going to learn on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. It's Savaziras, which is essentially his diary. And the other is a sefer called Achsharas Avreichim, which is the second sefer after Chovas HaTalmidim. It's for the next generation after Chovas Achsharas Avreichim, the next stage of life, I should say. In there, he has a piece on tefillah, which for me was a total game changer. You see, I always thought, up until I learned this piece, the following. I always thought that the way to approach davening is that you have to be as focused as humanly possible. And so what we do when we approach davening, in anticipation of davening, is we, so to speak, block out everything from our minds. Any distraction. I block out work. I block out anxieties. I block out challenges. In other words, I want to clear my head so that I can come fully focused into my relationship with Hashem. And for years, that was always like the Hineni. When the Chazon was doing Hineni, I was always trying to like clear out my head, block out my head, so that I can envision myself standing before the creator of the universe. That was always what Hineni was. And that's how I always thought davening was. So when the Gemara describes how the Hasidim Rishonim, the early pious ones, would sit an hour before davening, I always thought that they were sitting an hour before davening so that they can clear their head. As opposed to me who runs into Mincha from wherever I am and my brain is, they came in peaceful, with serenity. That was what I always thought. Says the Piyaz Etzron, that's not the case. It's not the case. And I'm going to tell it to you outside and then I'll read to you inside. He says, really what we should do before you come into davening is to flood your mind. Flood your mind with everything that bothers you. Flood your mind with everything that makes you anxious. Flood your mind with all of your challenges. Flood your mind with all of your problems. Fill yourself up with everything in life that's wrong. And then come into davening. And when you come into davening with that, filled with all your anxieties and filled with all your challenges and filled with all your problems, then what does davening become? Davening becomes a recognition that with all of my problems, there's one address where I can direct it all. And that only one address is to the Ribono Shel Olam. And that's ultimately what davening becomes. And so davening isn't where I clear out my head and then have this rendezvous with the creator of the universe. No, it's a lot more than that. It's a recognition that everything that's troubling me and all of my anxieties and all of my worries and the finances and the children and the job and the everything that's bothering me, now I take it to Hashem. And now I say, okay, now let's have a real conversation. Now let's talk, because I recognize, Hashem, that you are the only person who could solve all those problems for me. That doesn't mean he will, but there's the potential for that. Let's read inside. He says it so beautifully. Where I have the bracket. V'lo she'tavo pitom min hashuk v'tadaber diburim b'lo lev v'lo moach. He says, first of all, you shouldn't come into davening right from the marketplace without putting your heart into it, without having any mindfulness. Basically, don't do what most of us do when we run into mincha during the day, right? We're so scatterbrained. He says, rak titbonein mikodem. First, you should think. Think about everything that bothers you and everything that worries you. Then you think about all those things that bother you and you say to yourself, wait a second, where can I go? Who can I go to help me with all of these issues and all of these challenges? If not to Hashem, who's omnipotent and all-powerful, an all-capable and a merciful Father. Then, now that I have everything that's worrying me and I understand what Hashem is, now I can enter into a conversation with Him. And in your mind, I picture Hashem in front of me and then I let the floodgates open. Then I pour out my heart and I pour out my soul and I say, Hashem, all these things that are bothering me, I want to talk to you about them. I want to have a conversation about it. And then he says, but that's not the end. Because then what happens is, when you pour out your heart and soul to Hashem, when you recognize that relationship, I skipped a few lines, he says, Uma'at me'at ata ozev et sarche gufcha. Little by little, all of the things that worry you start becoming smaller and smaller. Why? Because you're standing in front of the master of the universe. And when you're standing in front of someone so great, your things seem a lot smaller. And so all of a sudden, it stops being about you and your physical, material needs. And all of a sudden, it becomes much more about coming close to the Ribono Shel Olam. Ribono Shel Olam, Karveini Elecha. And then you start davening. Hashem, draw me close to you. Taher Oti, purify me. Ha'eleo timi kol da'agos elu. Elevate me from all of these worries. Kedei she'ucha li'os karov elecha b'leiv v'nefesh tahor. All these problems, Hashem, are what keeping me from you. And that's ultimately the end goal. So Hashem, I'm not just asking you to solve my problems because I want more money or I want the bigger house or the nicer car or whatever. But it's because I want to have I want to be able to have peace of mind, to be able to daven to you and to be able to learn with you and to be able to have emunah with you. That's ultimately the goal. And so for me, This was a total paradigm shift in how one approaches tefillah. One doesn't approach tefillah by blocking out everything that worries them and allowing themselves with a completely clear head to go to Hashem. He says the opposite. He says, "Titbonein mikodem b'da'oscha." Think about everything that bothers you. Think about everything that bothers you and everything that worries you and everything that's causing you challenges. And then you say to yourself, who do I talk to? Who more than anybody else has the ability to help me? Ah, it's to Hashem. And now tefillah takes on an entirely new structure, an entirely new meaning. In fact, Motzei Shabbos, we got rained out, but what we were going to do is Bodrus at the beach. One of the pieces that I was going to learn with everyone there was this piece about what it means to talk to Hashem. But a corollary to that, there's a very, very beautiful sefer called Hapkisha, which means the meeting. It's a whole sefer about how to talk to Hashem. Not just in davening, but how to talk to Hashem. And there he talks about this idea. And he says you should talk to Hashem about everything. Everything and anything. Why? Right? It's almost like absurd, some of the things some people talk to Hashem about. So he says, no, that's the point. It's not just about the thing that you're talking to Hashem about. It's about the relationship. And the more we feel that we're actually having a conversation with someone, then Hashem becomes real. Now Hashem isn't just some amorphous thing or entity, but he's someone who's ever present in my life. And so the way I envision talking to you or to another person in the conversations that we have, when I speak to my wife about something that's bothering me, she doesn't think it's silly. She doesn't think it's stupid. It's part of a relationship. That's what builds the relationship, when you confide in someone else. That ultimately is the purpose of tefillah. The purpose of tefillah is not just that Hashem is an ATM machine, because he's not. The purpose of tefillah is to be able to create and to foster that relationship. And the way we do that is by sharing, in confiding, in being vulnerable, in showing those anxieties. All of that, I believe, is what the Piyaz Etzner Rebbe is writing here in a Sefer Achshar Savreichim. And so I encourage you in the lead up to Rosh Hashanah, I encourage you on Rosh Hashanah, that I think this is a very beautiful approach to tefillah. It's a very beautiful approach to tefillah, dafka, to take everything that you're struggling with into davening, not to block it out. If we block it out, it's a fake conversation. If we take it with it into the conversation, it frames everything about why we are standing in shul on Rosh Hashanah, what tefillah is about, and what ultimately a relationship with Hashem is about as well. So we saw idea number one was from Rabbi Lam, the shofar gadol, shofar katan, passive versus active. Rosh Hashanah, Hashem says, you got to take the first step. Idea number two, achshar savreichim, what is davening and what is it not? Idea number three comes from, I've had this for a very long time, it's from a rabbi, he's actually making aliyah soon, Rabbi Daniel Karapkin, who's now a rabbi in the Bayit in Toronto, or Toronto, as they refer to it. And he, this is a long, long time ago, wrote this. It's a very beautiful idea. He says, in explaining the process of judgment during the Yom Noraim, we may suggest two prerequisites in our Amunah are necessary in order to properly stand before Hashem in judgment. So there are two parts of judgment on Rosh Hashanah. Number one is, of course, we have to believe in reward and punishment. We have to believe that there are consequences. Why do we have to believe there are consequences, by the way? Because it's all a system. If we believe there's consequences, we believe there's free will. Free will and consequences means that I can also change. So that's the cycle of tshuva. That's why the Rambam puts it all in his Hilchos Tshuva. He puts in free will in tshuva. He puts in scharva onesh in Hilchos Tshuva. It's all one big package. That's what we all know Rosh Hashanah to be. But then he says there's another component to it. This is even more difficult type of emunah. We must believe in ourselves. We must believe that we are worthy of a fair judgment and that we are capable of receiving judgment for a good new year. This type of emunah is not as easy as it sounds. So emunah number one was, you have to believe, obviously, Hashem. You have to believe in system of judgment, reward and punishment. Judgment number two, belief number two, emunah number two is, we have to believe in ourselves. And in many ways, he writes, that's even harder to do. Because so many of us subconsciously write ourselves off before Rosh Hashanah, right? I could give so many examples right now that if I gave the example, many of you have already written yourselves off to. How about starting a Gemara Shir, joining a Gemara Shir? Rabbi, I don't have a background. I'm not the type of guy who learns Gemara, right? How about dieting, exercise? Rabbi, That's not like, you know, I've tried, I've failed 14 times. I'm not the guy who's going to get into shape this year, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's making minyan on time. Maybe whatever it is, if we're honest with ourselves, so many of the things that we know we need to change, we don't, because in our minds, we've already convinced ourselves that I'm not that person. I'm not the guy who learns Gemara. I'm not the guy who makes minyan. I'm not the guy who diets. I'm not the guy who whatever. We all have that narrative in our head. It's a subconscious narrative. But the problem is that we write ourselves off. We make ourselves guilty before we've even tried. So listen to the analogy he says. To me, this is such a beautiful analogy. This, if read this at your yontif table. Read this tomorrow night at your yontif table. I promise you it'll change people's Rosh Hashanah. He writes to illustrate. There was once a very dynamic and flamboyant defense attorney defending his client accused of murder. He said to the full courtroom, "I will now prove that my client is innocent, because in reality, the victim is still alive. To prove it, the victim will walk into this courtroom now." Now everyone, as you can imagine, turned their eyes to the doors of the courtroom, but no one walked through. After a few moments of silence, the attorney addressed himself to the jury. Quote, "I made up that story about the victim walking through the door, but I said it to make a point. The fact that you thought that perhaps the victim would walk through the door proves that you still have reasonable doubt as to whether or not my client is guilty of murder. I therefore ask for a verdict of not guilty." Now that seems pretty compelling to me. But the jury deliberated and after a few hours came back to announce its verdict of guilty. Later, the surprised lawyer went over to the foreman of the jury and asked, "What happened to my argument?" Right? That's a pretty like mic drop argument. Pretty convincing, he says. "So what happened to it?" The foreman answered, "It's true. We all looked at the doors to see if the victim would walk through. The only person, however, who didn't look was your client." That's wow. Good, right? Wow. It's powerful, right? Wow. Says Rabbi Kropotkin, "Some of us can associate with the defendant in this story. We've already written ourselves off as guilty, incapable of receiving grace from Hashem. We also sometimes don't care enough about ourselves to try and save ourselves by petitioning to Hashem in a proper way." And so many of us are like the defendants. We don't believe we're worthy. We don't believe we're worthy. We don't believe we can change. We don't believe in ourselves. Everyone else believes in us, but we don't believe in ourselves. And says Rabbi Kropotkin, that is a great impediment to tshuva. Because so long as you don't believe in yourself, it's impossible. It's never going to be possible. No matter how much everyone else believes in you, no matter how much everyone, if you don't believe in yourself, dead on arrival, it's not going to happen. It actually very much ties into our first idea tonight about passive and active, right? We have to believe in ourselves to make change. We have to believe that we can change. That's the entire foundation of this time of the year. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, if you ask me, like there's one commonality theme throughout all of it, is that we have the ability to change. If Hashem didn't believe we have the ability to change, then he can't hold us accountable. The fact that Hashem holds us accountable means it's because he believes that we can change. And therefore, if we made mistakes or we fell short or we disappointed, if Hashem holds us accountable, it's because he knows we could have done better. If we can't do better, we can't be held accountable for it. I don't believe that I'm held accountable that I don't learn 22 hours a day. I don't believe after 120 years, Hashem's going to say, "Philip Moskowitz, why didn't you learn 122 hours a day?" I don't think I can. I think there are people that can, not me. I think that there is a sweet spot where I am accountable for. And when I don't push myself in that sweet spot, Hashem says, "The reason why I hold you accountable is because I believe you could have done a little bit more, because I believe you could have pushed yourself a little bit further." But we have a narrative in our heads. We have a narrative that says, "I can't, I won't, I'm not that guy, right? I'm too firm, I'm not firm enough," right? We all have, "My friends are going to laugh at me, my friends aren't going to take me." Whatever it is, there's so many excuses that fill our head for how we have it, like this narrative in our head, how we rationalize our shortcomings and rationalize our failures, either by saying, it's not what something I can do, or it's not me, or no. If Hashem believes in us and Hashem believes we can change, the only impediment oftentimes is us believing in ourselves. So that, I think, is a very powerful idea. It touches upon free will. It touches upon reward and punishment. It touches upon so many ideas of Rosh Hashanah. And I think it pushes us. I think it pushes us to think of one thing this year, that you say to yourself, "You know what? Up until now, I said I can't do it. But this year I'm going to try it. I don't want to say what it is, but I recently, I'm 2 weeks in, but I took a new Kabbalah, I took a new commitment on myself, whatever it is. In about a year and a half, please God, I'll share what the commitment was, okay, when I successfully complete it, okay? But anyways, I told it to my son. I wanted him to see that even his father is not perfect. I know it's hard to believe, but even his father is working on himself. So he said to me, he heard about it, he said, "Ooh, Daddy, you sure you can do that? That's really hard." I said to him, I said, "Well, here's what I do know." I said, "I'll never know if I don't try. And so I'm going to try. I've done it 2 weeks. And Dayenu, by the way, if I don't even get it the next week, like it was worth it for 2 weeks. But most of you know me by now. And perhaps only rivaling Rabbi Goldberg, I might be the most competitive person in the world. But the only one I'm competing with here is myself. I made a commitment. I'm going to follow through on it. My point is that sometimes we stretch ourselves. It doesn't have to be big things. It could be little things. But it's a stretch for us. And each one on our own levels are going to stretch ourselves in a slightly different way. But if you don't push yourself and you don't try it, then I guarantee you're never going to be able to get there. The example I always give, and what this will conclude, is running, training. I don't know if anyone else is a runner here. But in running, one of the things you do, I've written about it, VO2 max. One of the things you do in running is little by little, you push yourself a little bit further than what you're able to, and then you almost pull back. And the next time you do it, and then you pull back. But each time you've moved the marker just a little bit more. And by doing so, what you've essentially showed your body is that I'm capable of more than I thought I was last week. And those incremental changes over time lead up to a half marathon, a marathon, a better time, whatever the example might be. Judaism is the exact same. Judaism, we all have barriers. The same way our body tells us you can't, so we psychologically tell ourselves we can. But if we don't push ourselves out of that comfort zone little by little, we'll never know what we're capable of. And if we don't push ourselves because we don't believe in ourselves, then we'll never realize our full potential. And so we saw three ideas in 30 minutes, a little bit less. Idea number one, shofar gadol, shofar katan, passive versus active, a very beautiful idea. Idea number two, achsharas avreichem, the piyazetzin rebbe, about what it means to daven, to flood yourselves with all of your anxieties and all your worries. And that's how we enter into the conversation with Hashem. Idea number three is not just to believe in Hashem and to believe in reward and punishment, but most importantly, to believe in ourselves, not to be like the defendant in our story, who everyone else believed in him, except for him, he already thought he was guilty. But if we don't believe in ourselves, then nothing is possible. It's only once we believe in ourselves, then the sky is truly the limit. And with that, I wish everyone a ksiva v'chasima tov.